The complicated legacy of FIU's now former president. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. FIU's president Mark Rosenberg suddenly resigned last week. Since then, we've learned about harassment accusations and his struggles to take care of his wife, who has dementia. Today, we'll get an update on what comes next for the man and the university. Also, rents are climbing with no end in sight. We're going to go to Hialeah, where a real estate investment firm bought an apartment building and increased monthly rent for the people living there by 65% starting next month. And a lawmaker is proposing to designate strawberry shortcake as Florida's official dessert. This has the Key Lime Pie community up in arms. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Florida International University President Mark Rosenberg abruptly resigned last week. The shakeup for the university's leadership comes as Rosenberg is accused of misconduct and harassing and making unwanted advances toward a young female colleague. Rosenberg began his career with FIU as an assistant professor of political science in 1976, 4 years after the university opened. The workplace issues spark a larger conversation about who will lead the university now and about the toll family caretakers can suffer. More on that in a moment. Joining us now is Miami Herald higher education reporter Ximena Tavel. She's been covering the story closely since the news broke. Ximena, great to have you.
Hi, Luis. Thank you. A pleasure.
What have university officials said publicly about how everything went down last week? I mean, a sudden announcement of Rosenberg's resignation and the vote on picking an interim president, it all happened so fast.
Yeah, the answer is not much, Luis. They haven't really said a lot. The Board of Trustees chairman, Dean Colson, he's a prominent attorney here in Miami. He broke the news on Friday afternoon. He sent out this cryptic three-paragraph email to the community, you know, saying Rosenberg would be stepping down, but he mentioned no reason why the president of, you know, the largest urban university in South Florida would leave. He then called an emergency meeting of the Board of Trustees, and they met for about 15 minutes, really quick video call. They barely mentioned Rosenberg and, you know, extended no praise for his accomplishments. Which really raised eyebrows, you know. He had been there, like you said, since 1976 and had a really long, extensive legacy. So, and you know, meanwhile, dozens of elected officials, higher education administrators, students, staff were all expressing sadness and thanking him for his service. So that was weird. But then on Sunday, Rosenberg revealed that he had left under the cloud of, you know, what he referred to as an emotional entanglement, quote unquote. And you know, that was basically referring to a misconduct allegation.
He was accused of harassing a female colleague, that there were a number of incidences between the two. What do we know happened?
Yeah, we don't. Well, I just wanted to tell you real quick that Colson then came back and did say that, you know, that was why they hadn't recognized his legacy. And that was why, you know, they hadn't really praised him on that Friday meeting, and that they were, you know, saddened by what had happened. But yes, sexual harassment between the two. We don't really know a lot about what's happening. The university is still investigating the alleged misconduct. But what we know is that an FIU employee, a younger woman in her 20s, who worked closely with Rosenberg, basically walked into her job in December and told one of her colleagues that she would be leaving because she felt uncomfortable with Rosenberg and that he had been harassing her.
After that happened, how long did it take FIU to investigate this incident and then approach Rosenberg about the situation?
Well, it was pretty quickly. She walked into her job on December 14th, told the colleague, told Rosenberg that she would be leaving. That day, Rosenberg picked up the phone and called Dean Colson, the chair of the board, and told him that what had happened, and the board of trustees chairman called and started an investigation into what had happened on December 15th.
And so they come to him. How long? I'm wondering how long after that they come to him and tell Rosenberg, look, either you quit or you're fired.
Yeah, that took a while. That took a while because, outside counsel comes in, launches an investigation, reaches out to the young woman, but they realize she's hesitant. She doesn't really want to talk. Understandably, she needed to get her head together and wanted to seek legal counsel as well. So it takes about, with the holidays and everything, it takes about a month until last Wednesday, January 19th, where they sit down with her and interview her. And really hear about what's happening from her, what had happened. And the next day they reach out to Rosenberg and give him this ultimatum of basically, you resign or we will call an emergency meeting of the Board of Trustees and terminate you.
And by the way, what's the difference here? Why ask him to resign? But what would be the difference? What would happen to him if he had decided not to and they fired him?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's a really good distinguish this the difference, he left, he was able to quit under a status called in good standing, which means that he is still entitled to the post-presidency benefits in his contract, outlined in his contract, which basically include a one-year sabbatical at full presidential salary, which is about $500,000. And after that one-year leave, he is eligible to resume his tenured professorship. So he could come back and teach for 3 years at 75% of his full salary, which is, roughly 370,000 bucks. But if he would have been forced to resign, then, obviously he wouldn't have left in good standing and he would have lost that.
And so he decides to resign, and so that affects his standing within the FIU community. And I'm wondering, how do they feel about him now with everything that's come out? What have you heard from the Board of Trustees? I mean, he's FIU's fifth president in its history.
Yeah, I think a lot of people loved Rosenberg before this. He had been there for a really long time. Every time I interviewed him, people would walk over, say hi, ask for pictures with him. He was approachable. He was fun. He was joyful. I think this comes as a shock to everyone. I think everyone is still trying to wrap their heads around it. They're trying to wait for that final report in the investigation. And really, try to see what the details are and understand what is happening.
But have you heard anything from even students or staff? Or I'm just wondering if opinions have moved.
Yeah, most of the faculty, staff, students I have spoken to have said they're very disappointed, frankly. Some faculty worry that the impact what the impact will be like on students, right? To have their top leader behave this way, allegedly. And also the impact on the university culture and reputation. Students who had, really extended their heartfelt messages to Rosenberg have sort of taken them back. And, it's a complicated situation.
I'm speaking with Miami Herald higher ed reporter Ximena Tavel. We're talking about the news that broke last week about FIU President Mark Rosenberg resigning abruptly amid being investigated for harassing a colleague. And so much has come out since then. Rosenberg responded in a letter, didn't he?
He did, he did. He took full responsibility of his actions, regretted his actions, and then he also, brought it back to mental health issues. He said that he has been suffering from mental health issues since October, which is allegedly when the harassment started. And he said his health has been impacted because of the strain of caring for his wife of 47 years. Her name is Rosalie. She has advanced dementia, MS, and uses a wheelchair for mobility. So he said that he has been her nightly caregiver for over a decade.
Yeah, what I mean, what did the university say about that, about the struggles that he's had with his wife?
Yeah, they haven't really said anything about the wife specifically, other than that statement from Colson on Sunday saying, we just thought that that wasn't the appropriate time to celebrate his accomplishments. And, we think we are deeply saddened and disappointed by the events, but they didn't really touch on the caregiving aspect of it.
And nothing to we can't say enough the struggles that caretakers go through, because I don't want to take that lightly. But do we know how difficult it is to find and afford care for someone with dementia in South Florida because he had a lot of resources.
Yeah, I think it's hard everywhere. Even, you know, I'm sure it's harder for people who make less than $500,000 a year. But I think it's hard for everyone because, you know, it's your loved one, right? You want to be there for them. You don't want a stranger to be taking care of them. And I think a lot of people have sympathy. You know, I have heard comments from readers saying, hey, you know, you can't really opine on this if you don't really know how heavy the burden of a caregiver is. But then again, others are saying, hey, sexual harassment isn't really a symptom of mental health issues. So you know, there's definitely a debate going on.
Do you think this starts a bigger conversation about that?
Yeah, I think it already has. Definitely.
Do you think did any of his colleagues talk about the toll that it was taking on Rosenberg, that maybe something was changing in him as his wife's condition was getting worse?
None that I have spoken to, Luis. My understanding is President Rosenberg was a really private person. People knew his wife was sick. They didn't really know the details of her condition or you know, how bad it was or how it had worsened, like Rosenberg said in his letter. So they didn't really know the role Rosenberg was playing or plays in her care.
So we go back to Friday when this announcement comes. Again, he wasn't even there. They made the announcement that he was resigning, said nothing else about him, then have a vote. The Board of Trustees named Kenneth Jessel as the interim president. Who is this guy? What do we know about him?
Yeah, Jessel used to be FIU CFO. It's chief financial officer, as well as its vice president of finance and administration. And he has served in that capacity since 2009, until Friday, of course. So for a really long time, before that, before coming to FIU, Jessel had a long career at FAU, Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, also a public school. And he worked there for more than 25 years under different capacities. He was a provost. He was a professor at one point, dean of the College of Business, a bunch of experience. And that's something that a board of trustees told me about Jessel. He said that he was an astute man with numbers, but also, you know, he liked that he had experience with the academia, the academic part of it.
So what happens now? Is the FIU Board of Trustees already start a search for the permanent president?
They haven't yet, no. They are still awaiting the report of the investigation, presumably. They haven't made any announcements of the search process, which, as you know, tends to be a really complex process. So they would need to first call a committee. That's how it usually happens, and hold, you know, public meetings, put out a call for applications, that kind of stuff. But at the moment, it's all still up in the air. I think they're awaiting for that investigation to wrap up, which is scheduled to be, or hopefully, you know, in the next couple of weeks.
Look, as you said, Rosenberg was loved. He was respected. A lot of people love the guy. And he has this, he has a legacy at the university for decades, because as the president, he brought in a lot of money. How do we look at people like him? You think about his accomplishments, how he helped build and expand the school, bring in all this money. But, you know, it ends like this.
Yeah, I think, I think an aspect of that discussion needs to be, we don't really know the details of it yet until that final report comes out. But, you know, I think this goes back to a larger debate that we're having as a society, right? Like, do we separate the art from the artist in a sense? And you know, is that, do should we do that? Can we do that? You know, I think we should remember that Rosenberg isn't responsible for all of the success FIU has experienced, though. There's thousands of students and employees over the years that have been doing that. It's not just the boat's captain.
Right. No, nothing to take away from anybody else. And, you know, but obviously he's going to have his legacy. And there, as you said, there's going to be the question about separating the two. What happens to him now? You said a moment ago that because he resigned, so he forfeits his $500,000 a year salary, but because he resigned, he can come back to teach for a pretty hefty price.
Yeah, that's his decision. So there's two things at play here. One of them is his contract, which allows him, he is entitled under that contract to come back and teach for 3 years, like I said, at 75% of his full salary, but $70,000. And then there's another thing called, tenure, right? Which is really respected, probably the highest status that an academician can have. In terms of his contract, he can decide whether he wants to come back or not. In terms of tenure, depending on what that investigation reveals, the university could bring up a proceeding and try to strip him of that status, which could, hinder his plans in that sense.
But
Does that make sense?
we haven't heard whether or not he's going to do that, that he's going to come
Well,
back.
he said in his letter that that was his intention
Okay.
to go back to what he called his first love. But I reached out to his lawyer yesterday for comment and to, to confirm that if that still stands. And I haven't heard back yet.
And we did receive a statement, by the way, from Dean C. Colson, the chair of the FIU Board of Trustees. He wrote this, the following quote: "We're deeply saddened and disappointed by the events requiring Rosenberg's resignation. Due to employee privacy considerations, FIU is not going to comment further at this time. FIU has strong personnel and workplace conduct policies, takes all workplace conduct seriously, and remains committed to enforcing its policies thoroughly and swiftly," end quote. This is a fascinating story. So much more to tell. Obviously, they're going to be looking for a new leader, but what happens to Rosenberg? And again, how people are going to view his legacy from this point forward. Jimenez, such a pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Louise, of course.
Jimenez Tavel, again, Miami Herald's higher ed reporter. You can share your thoughts, by the way, on this story. So many current students and alum here from FIU. I'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Tell us what you think. How we see Rosenberg moving forward. Well, still to come, rents keep climbing. We're going to go to Hialeah, where we see the numbers reaching painful highs for some people. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Rent prices in South Florida have increased faster than anywhere else in the country. There's been a surge in demand for housing here, especially over the past year. Now, the state as a whole is on track to becoming one of the least affordable in the nation. Meanwhile, wages are growing at a rate behind the national average. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero has more details on this story.
South Florida has seen a surge of newcomers during the course of the pandemic, coming from places like California and New York. And many of them are coming with high-paying jobs. That's caused an explosion of demand for housing in a place that's long been one of the most unaffordable areas of the nation, leading to an eye-popping rise in property values and rents. In the last year alone, rents increased about 36% in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm Beach, according to the real estate website Redfin. These three cities make up the top three highest rent hikes anywhere in the nation. And this is a new reality that affects all kinds of people. People like Stephanie Cauley.
We are in my efficiency in Liberty City, Miami, where I pay $900 a month for, and if I renew my lease for after May, it would be $1,100.
Her 250 square foot unit sits just feet away from a busy road. Shootings happen all the time nearby. And this used to be a business space until the landlord made it into an efficiency.
Yeah, it has its problems. My sink has been like leaking since.
Stephanie lives here with her two children who both have autism.
I keep all their toys and stuff in bags and everything under here. I'll pull like certain things out for them to play with. I don't let them play with all their toys at once because it will take up the whole room.
Stephanie wondered what could provoke a 22% rate increase. She says she asked her landlord about it.
She was like, well, you're in a hot spot. And I was like, what's the hot spot? And she was like, I'm about eight minutes away from like Wynwood, and I'm like 10 to 15 minutes away from the airport. So people would like, it's a hot spot for people to live that travel and things like that. So that's why the rent has to go up.
So Stephanie started looking for a new place back in October. She works for a temp agency and she already puts almost half her pay into rent. But she says she could cough up a little bit more money if it means getting a bigger place for her kids to run around in. And she says she found a good one down the street until it was time to talk about money.
And I'm like, $1,600 a month for a one bedroom. And he's like, yeah, I need first, last, and security. And I'm like, okay, thank you for that. I'm always looking for something to give me extra income. Like, I do, like, odd jobs on the weekend. I'll, like, I used to work at the stadium just on the weekend when they had games and stuff. Like, I'll do anything, like, to get extra income because Miami is very hard to afford.
And since money's so tight, it's almost impossible to save, which makes moving to a cheaper part of the state out of the question.
If I don't find a place by, like, March or April, I'll just have to renew because I can't just say, like, no, I'm not going to stay here. I have to have a place for my kids. So, yeah, I would just probably stay here and endure it another year.
In a working-class neighborhood of Hialeah, residents are protesting a rent increase of up to 65% for some tenants. The new developer, who bought the building and hiked up the rents, did not respond to requests for comment. Denio Abel Sierra is a truck driver who lives in the building.
Que haya un tope con la renta, según el área de donde se vive.
He says there needs to be a cap on rent, depending on the area, because the working-class people of Hialeah can't pay the kind of rates being charged on Miami Beach, for example. Residents have until the end of the month to pay the new rate or move out. Rachel Ruby is 24, and she's lived in the building her entire life with her Nicaraguan mother. She was the main resident who organized the protest.
We don't have anywhere else to go. Our like option would be to move in with our aunt, with my aunt, for the meantime to see if we can find something, but like realistically, it's basically like being houseless.
I think we're going to see a lot more kids and a lot more elders become homeless. I think you're going to see quality of life deteriorate and people are going to be stressed and there's going to be greater poverty.
Annie Lord is the executive director of Miami Homes for All, an advocacy group that aims to eliminate homelessness, especially in Miami-Dade.
I don't know if there's going to be an instant tipping point or if there will be some kind of gradual impact. But if we do nothing, I can't see how we avoid that. There's no way to avoid that.
Lord says local governments and the state government need to put significantly more funding into building new homes for people on the lowest end of the economic ladder. That's because a lot of housing dollars and policies go towards developing so-called workforce housing for professionals like teachers and firefighters, and not the poorest. And the surge of newcomers in South Florida has only made the situation worse for the working poor, since increased competition has driven rental rates up. She fears this can have a big impact on the regional economy.
This is a significant element of our workforce. And how does that economy get driven?
Keisha Guyden lived and worked in Broward County until last May. That's when the duplex she was living in was sold, and the new owner moved into her side. She moved back in with her parents in Miami Gardens and is sleeping in her childhood bedroom.
I'm with my two children. They're full-time college students, and they're sleeping on the couch, and, you know, and I sleep in the bedroom. But, you know, that they used to have their own bedroom.
The sale of her old home unexpectedly pushed Keisha back onto the real estate market looking for a three-bedroom apartment. And she was shocked at what she saw.
Every time I go to a place, even in a place where I thought maybe, oh, this is a regular neighborhood, it ain't going to be that much. And places was $2,500. I went to places that was $3,500.
Keisha has a Section 8 voucher that she transferred to Miami-Dade since she's living with her parents in Miami Gardens. But even with that voucher, which is guaranteed rent money for any landlord, Keisha's having trouble finding somewhere to live. And many of the applications she's putting in force her to spend money just to be considered as a tenant. Like, she remembers this one apartment she was interested in.
For me to qualify, ready to listen to this? Every person over 18 will have to pay $250, non-refundable. It's three of us over 18.
That's $750 just to be considered. And Keisha has been unemployed for a few months now.
I'm starting to see if I don't get any help, I may have to move up north where it's cheaper. Probably like Pompano, Palm Bay, Cocoa. I may have to take my voucher and see if I can transfer up north.
That would mean moving up the coast and away from her family. But it could also mean getting her children off the couch and into their own rooms.
And that was WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. To continue this conversation about affordable housing in South Florida, I want to turn now to Norma Uriostegui. She's the Miami Workers Center's housing organizer. Norma, I really appreciate the time. Thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You know, there are reports about a surge in the demand for housing here. Tell me what you see.
Yeah, definitely in the time that I've been with the Workers Center, what I'm seeing most of all is a lot of displacement. A lot of people, or rather a housing crisis that has been like exacerbated by the pandemic. People come to Florida, people come to Miami in particular, a lot of wealth and a lot of wealthy people coming into Miami and honestly just buying working class families out of their homes.
Over these last few years, have things gotten worse?
I would say so. I think especially like with the crisis, with the global pandemic crisis that we had, a lot of people who were one paycheck away from like from losing their homes, like it's exactly what happened, you know, people getting evicted throughout the pandemic, even with the moratorium and the conditions that it was set as, like with the conditions that it was set as, it actually didn't protect people completely from being evicted. I know during 2020, at least over 18,000 evictions were filed and people were kicked out of their homes during a public health crisis.
You know, I know that a lot of people who work in your organization also are renters, and I wonder what's been your experience with housing in South Florida?
Yeah, I moved to South Florida. I moved to Miami in particular maybe about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. And rent was expensive. Right now I'm living with my in-laws. It's not something that that I would choose, right? I'm definitely like very I have the privilege of having somewhere to go, but
all right, it looks like I'm having connection issues at the moment with Norma. Norma, I don't know if you can hear me, if you're there. If not, we'll try to reconnect. We'll see if we can reconnect maybe perhaps by phone. My deepest apologies on that. Again, I'm talking with Norma Uriostegui. She is with the Miami Workers Center's housing organization. She's an organizer with them, I should say. And again, we're talking about affordable housing, finding affordable housing here in South Florida, finding rents that are affordable here in South Florida. We heard the story earlier from Danny Rivero. By the way, you could find that story on our website, WLRN.org. But looking at this issue of rents climbing in South Florida, you know, especially over these last couple of years, you know, how bad has it gotten? And we're going to get Norma back on here in just a moment, but I really would love to hear from you. You're living here in South Florida, not just in Miami, from Palm Beach County through Broward County, Miami-Dade, and Monroe County. I'd love to hear these last few months, 6 months or so, what have you seen in your rent? You know, has your rent gone up? Maybe $100, a couple $100? Has it gone up even more than that? And what is it forcing you to do? Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Share your story with us. You can always text us as well, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Because there was, you know, we had heard in the story of Danny Rivero's story of a real estate investment firm that bought an apartment building and then increased the monthly rent by 65% starting the very next month. So you had people who were paying $1,000 a month for rent now having to pay $1,650 a month. What happens to those folks if they can't afford that? And again, if that's happening to you, if you're seeing that around South Florida, share again your story with us. Let me give you a couple ways to do it. You can text us, 786-677-0767. 7867. That's 786-677-0767. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Also, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Let me see. I think, do I have Norma back there yet? Norma, are you there?
I'm pretty sure you do.
All right. There you are.
Sorry. Do you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Fantastic. Yes, you know what, Norma? Apologize about that. Sometimes technical issues do jump in the way. You know, Norma, I was just mentioning, because we had heard it in Danny's story, that story about the apartment building where they raised rent 65% in that next month. I mean, how are you and your workers involved in this particular story? This is touching some of the folks you know.
Yeah, definitely. So we got involved with this organizing with this building, that building in Hialeah in particular, after one of the tenants, Rachel Ruby, reached out to us. So we got involved. We're basically there. We do leadership development. You know, we support whatever organizing efforts the tenants wanted through it all. But yeah, from 1 month to another, days before Christmas, they received a notice saying at first that they had to leave by January 31st, and then saying, okay, if you don't want to leave, you can pay us this $1,650, the new price for the rent, when most of them are paying about $1,000. And that was after they raised the rent on them $100 in November. So really, in the past 3 months, it's gone up for a lot of people, over $700. A lot of working class families, a lot of folks that are retired, that are living on fixed incomes, that, you know, this is just unheard of. You know, they've lived in Miami, in Hialeah in particular, there's plenty of residents there and that have lived there for over 10, 15, 20 years. You know, kids that were born and raised there. So it's a very dramatic story. And unfortunately, it's also not uncommon.
You've seen other
with working class families.
You've seen other stories like this, other cases where the rent went up that much? Or close to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's happening all over the county, to be honest. And like, even after being public with this story in particular, you know, people being reaching out to us, you know, saying it's happened to them. It's happened even more. Somebody reached out to us in Little Havana saying their rent went up over $1,000, which is just, you know, tell me you want me to leave without telling me you want me to leave, you know, like, is actually the message being sent to these people who, you know, are not just going to get a whole nother paycheck out of nowhere.
So what are you hearing from these people who can't afford that increase? What are they doing?
Well, right now they've gotten together. They've formed a tenants union within their building called La Unión de los Vecinos. They've been putting in their organizing efforts and sending a collective letter, reaching out to EcoStone, trying to negotiate with them, right? Trying to sit down and talk with them, as ultimately this is very inhumane and unjust and also completely legal. So they really just wanted to reach out and directly communicate with the landlords. Like, and when that wasn't working, you know, they did their public protest. We've went to their offices last week to try to deliver the letter in person. EcoStone has avoided all responsibility, has not responded to a single call, like anything. So right now they're actually being reached out to by the city of Hialeah, to try to, you know, make some sort of rent assistance efforts happen, which is extremely helpful to them. But ultimately, like, the root of the problem is still there. EcoStone did manage to do this to these residents, you know, directly responsible for this rental increase, and might just be getting away with it.
And you know what, one of the interesting things too is this, because people will ask, what rights do I have as a tenant? There is a tenant bill of rights.
A tenant bill of rights is actually what we're pushing for. So we have a campaign within our housing. Yeah, we have a campaign within our housing organizing at the Miami Workers Center called the Tenant Bill of Rights Campaign. It's basic protections, you know, something sustainable so that tenants can rely on things like knowing what their rights even are, if they have any rights, you know, things like, if they're living in uninhabitable conditions, like actually being able to speak up and not being retaliated against, you know, things that already exist. But if a law exists and it's not being enforced, then what do we have? You know, we actually. Sorry,
there,
were you
no,
ask
no, there, there was some. Well, no, there's something interesting to this. You know, because all right, we went through a pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs and could not pay their rent. Now you had landlords, and some of them are small. Not all of them are big. You know, big groups. Some of them are small. They lost a lot as well. What happens though? Like, is this just something that we're going to have to accept that, you know, landlords, their insurance rates are going up, the cost of living is going up, and they got to keep up. They got to try to make it too. What happens in this case? What do we do?
Yeah, no, I hear that for sure. I think at some point, you know, not just in Miami, but in general, there were smaller landlords, right? I think what we're seeing in Miami now is like EcoStone managed to do with this building, a lot of buildings are being bought out by corporate landlords. They're not necessarily, you know, a single person renting out a property that they own. You know, I think in every case that I've personally worked with, it's always been a company, you know, from out of state. This one happens to be in Miami, but it's usually a company. They're usually catering to investors. I think if you go on EcoStone's website, you can see exactly what their strategy is, which is to flip buildings.
Yeah.
They do this, and that's what we're seeing a lot of, like more than anything. I don't think it's completely impossible that smaller landlords exist. Obviously, you know, if they have to do what they have to do to keep up. I think tenants also need some sort of protection, since the law right now, as it exists in the state of Florida, is not in their favor at
and
that, all.
Yeah. And again, to differentiate here in the story, look, there are all kinds of landlords, but in this particular story, it's a real estate investment firm, a much bigger firm. I do want to mention, I mean, we've been hearing from different folks, you know, on our social media. We heard from one of our listeners via Twitter, Dwayne in Pompano. I'm a small landlord, just raised the rent on one of my properties by 10% after not increasing it for 4 years. People tell me I could do so much more, but I can't go in good conscience do that. By the way, and it's Dawn, my apologies. Sundahl did call and email EcoStone Group, by the way, the apartment building's new owner, for their comment on this story, and they could not be reached. Norma, I appreciate you taking the time, a story we need to dig a little deeper into here and follow and see where are we going as a community? Where are we going with this? So
yeah,
I really
absolutely.
Appreciate, I appreciate the time and the insight. We'll be talking again soon.
Yeah, of course. If I could just say one more thing.
Okay, briefly.
Yeah, very briefly. What the tenants managed to do and all of the noise they managed to do is because they organized, you know, and that's what we encourage, and that's what we're here to support within the Miami Worker Center. Ultimately, that is a real solution to this very real crisis that we're facing right now.
Norma Uriostegui with the Miami Worker Center's housing organization. Norma, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Of course. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. And Don, my apologies. I misread your name. Don, thank you for sharing your story with us on social media. Well, still to come, let's change things up here, folks. The great debate over which dessert best represents the state. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We are going to shine the key limelight on Florida's dessert debate, and it's gotten personal. There's a bill moving through the legislature this session that would designate strawberry shortcake as the official dessert of the state of Florida. This doesn't sit well with South Florida's key lime community. Key lime pie has been the state's official pie since 2006. Joining me now to discuss which dessert better represents Florida is author David Sloan. He co-founded the Key Lime Festival in Key West and wrote the Key West Key Lime Pie Cookbook. David, it is a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
By the way, you know what? Listen, I mean, I'm having fun with this, but at the same time, as fun as the story may be, and it is a very tasty story, of course, it's serious for you. This is really serious.
Yeah, it's very serious. You know, in the Florida Keys, we like to handle things with humor. But when you look at it, key lime pie, it's done so much for the state of Florida. And I think any sane person, if you ask them, hey, what dessert is best suited to represent the state? I think 10 out of 10 people are going to tell you key lime pie. I don't think a single one is going to say strawberry shortcake. And they're selling a lot of strawberries.
And, you know, all right, so strawberry shortcake, just so we know, everybody knows where this is from. The Senator Danny Burgess filed a bill to designate strawberry shortcake as Florida's official dessert. Now, this is important to know. Obviously, it's not going to be the state pie or the state cake. It's dessert. What was your initial reaction when you heard that, by the way?
Well, I think it's just silly. I completely understand why they want to bring attention to the strawberry industry in Florida. I think they provide something like 75% of the winter crop. So that's great. And you can't blame them for wanting a designation. But I think the way they're approaching it, it's, you know, trying to push key lime out. Because we have represented Florida as the dessert for 16 years. And there's no reason that they should, you know, let strawberry shortcake be the official cake and let them both share the limelight.
So you don't mind if it's called the official cake, but not the dessert. That's the important aspect here.
That's the important thing. And all it takes is an amendment to the bill, you know, just to change one word. There's already some amendments taking place. The Florida dairy industry is getting involved, and they're saying topped with a Florida-made dairy product. So you can make the amendments, and all it would take is for Jim Mooney to make that amendment. And that's what we're asking him to do.
Now, just to mention, you know, Sundahl reached out to Senator Burgess. He sent us a statement that is very brief and to the point. He said this, quote, "Stand tall for shortcake," end quote. That's what he sent us. I'm not kidding. You know what, David, where did your passion for key lime pie come from?
Well, when I moved to Key West, I came here to start up a ghost tour, and I ended up in the Curry Mansion, which was the home of Florida's first millionaire. And I was in their kitchen, and I saw a little recipe card, and it said, "This is the birthplace of key lime pie." And I'd been a baker when I was 16 years old, and I used to make key lime pies. And I thought, whoa, this is like, I'm here where it was born. And the thing is, they said it was created by Aunt Sally, but nobody knew who Aunt Sally was. And I like reverse engineering legends. So I said, I'm going to find out who Aunt Sally is. And it took my life in the direction of key lime pie. And I just became obsessed with it ever since.
And you know,
we were able to find out who Aunt Sally is.
I don't need to tell you, you know, there are people who say, wait a second, key lime started in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another silly debate. We have some good evidence. You know, there was I think there's probably 6 or 7 pieces of evidence of key lime pie predating the 1931 date that author claimed was when it was created in New York. I mean, I've got one recipe, and it says it was published in the Miami Herald, and it said, this is the recipe that the Blackwell family has been using for over 50 years. And with that 50 years, that would place it at 1889. So it's been around for some time.
Again, I'm talking with David Sloan, author of the Key West Key Lime Pie Cookbook. We're talking about this issue. Key lime pie is the state pie, the official Florida state pie. But as I said, Senator Danny Burgess has put in a bill to make strawberry shortcake the state dessert. And what David is asking for is a, you know, an amendment to that, just saying make it the state cake, but not the state dessert. You know, this is interesting. You mentioned this a second ago. Why the push for strawberry shortcake? Well, because Florida does produce a large percentage of the strawberries in the wintertime. So that's one of the arguments being made is that, you know, we make a lot of strawberries. So I'm going to let you go ahead and that's their defense. I don't have them here. That's going to be their defense. How do you counter that?
Well, I'd say, yeah, you make a bunch of strawberries. Why don't you go for a designation as Florida's official fruit? It's because you have to go up against the Orange Council. And we know that they're not going to like that. You know, orange is the official fruit. I think the official drink is orange juice. So, you know, orange juice is represented well. But, you know, changing it to a dessert, if you go out to eat in Florida, count how many restaurants have key lime pie on the menu. And how many times you've seen strawberry shortcake on the menu? I bet you've never seen strawberry shortcake on a Florida menu. So to say that this should represent Florida, it just doesn't make sense.
And of course, if their argument is that they produce a lot of strawberries, and they'll say, well, we're not producing as many key limes.
Right. Well, you know what? You know, our official animal is the Florida panther, and we produce a lot more mosquitoes than we do Florida panthers. The Florida panther's endangered, but you don't see us naming the mosquito the official animal of Florida. So going by volume, you know, that just doesn't make sense. It should be something that represents the state. And when you think about Key Lime Pie, you know, you're thinking about sun, you're thinking about sand, you're thinking about tropical breezes, and it brings people a taste of Florida no matter where they are. If you serve somebody strawberry shortcake, they think of the 1980s cartoon character. I can't tell you how many people when I mentioned strawberry shortcake, they said the cartoon character. So think about what we're really representing. Why are we doing this?
Have you heard from, you know, from Tallahassee? Have you heard from Senator Burgess's office or anybody in Tallahassee? Have they responded to this?
Yes. Of course, they have a lot of things going on that they'll say that are more important. And I get that. But Paul Menta, who's part of the Key Lime Pie Council here, he's been in touch with our representative, Jim Mooney. And he's pushing him to make the change. We do not have any confirmation on that yet.
You know, coming back to the key lime thing, by the way, where are we getting our key limes?
Key limes come from different places. You know, in Redland, Florida, there's a few small groves. In Key West, you have the backyard crops. You know, just people will have a couple of trees in their backyard. And those are the highly sought after pies made with those. A lot of the juice now, it comes from Mexico. Mexico has the good growing conditions for that. So they'll be grown over there and then processed into juice.
But are key limes almost like endangered here in Florida?
Between development, saltwater intrusion, hurricanes, things like that, the crops have dwindled from what they once were. And that's another reason why it's important to keep the key lime out there. I mean, you know, the key in key lime is from the Florida Keys. That's where it comes from.
Yeah. All right. So if this bill goes through, I mean, what happens next?
Well, I think they should make the amendment. That's what they'll do. I don't think it's going to affect the number of people eating key lime pie. I don't think it's going to make any more people eat strawberry shortcake. But when you look at things, you know, we're very proud about our heritage in Key West, and the key lime is such an important part of that. You know, it tells our history, it tells a story, and that's why it's important.
Did I hear right? This could end with a dessert duel.
Yeah. You know, if Plant City doesn't want to play ball on this, then our vice mayor, under the official bylaws of the Concord Public, he's challenged Senator Burge, their vice mayor, to a dessert duel. And what you do for a dessert duel, you both arm yourselves with your favorite dessert. I'm assuming this would be a key lime pie and a strawberry shortcake. And you stand back to back, take 10 paces, turn around and fire.
Now, I think just from that, you already have the advantage. I think the key lime pie is a little more aerodynamic.
I think it definitely is. You know, it's just another reason why it should be the official state pie and dessert.
All right, you got to do me a favor. I can't let you go without asking. Tell me, what is the key to making a really good key lime pie?
Well, people always ask where the best key lime pie is. And I always say the best key lime pie is the one you're about to eat.
I'm going to debate you because I've had some that just, I walk away angry. I walk away angry. I'm like, I'm not ordering from this place ever again.
It's a shame when, you know, some places they'll make a Cisco pie, and Cisco makes good pies, but whenever you can get a homemade key lime pie, those are by far the best. And I always say you use the best ingredients. And what I think makes it really nice, add your own little secret ingredients in there. I like to add a little bit of vanilla ice cream, real vanilla bean ice cream, and that adds a great taste. The old conks used to say you use 6 eggs for visitors and 3 eggs for family.
Mm. By the way, what differentiates key limes from the regular variety?
They're more tart. They're tarter. They've got a better flavor. They're juicier.
You know, I mean, look, we're having fun with this, but I know, like I said, you're taking this very seriously. And this is not about saying no to the shortcake, strawberry shortcake. It's just saying amend the word. Don't call it Florida's dessert. Just call it Florida's cake. Key lime pie will remain the pie for the state of Florida.
Yeah, and there's no reason that we wouldn't share the limelight with strawberry shortcake. And, you know, they have a great strawberry festival there. Maybe they could serve up some key lime pie. And down here, we have a great key lime festival. We'd be happy to put some strawberries on our key lime pie.
Listen, David.
And that way we can really all get along.
David, I'm not going to lie. I want to see the dessert duel. That's all. I'll be front row. I want to see it.
I'm right there with you.
David Sloan, author of the Key West Key Lime Pie Cookbook. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Love and limes.
Definitely. And by the way, you could vote on the WLRN Instagram in our stories to share with us which dessert you think better represents Florida. Is it going to be the key lime pie or the strawberry shortcake? We got a poll going, so, you know, place your vote there. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, January 26, 2022. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to hear what Miami-Dade County's new superintendent, Jose Dotres, has to say. He sat down with our new education reporter, Kate Payne, and we'll hear more of that interview coming up tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can listen to the program tonight at 8 o'clock if you missed any of it, or find us on your podcast app. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
10 shots of cruising rum. Hey, I like it a lot with my key lime pie.
WLRN Public Media.